The headlines: Israel launches airstrikes on a besieged Gaza Strip amid heightened tensions following the regime's deadly raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Palestinians say the Israeli raid on Nablus was part of the regime's systematic terrorism, saying the right response is resistance across the occupied territories. And Iran's leader says some hostilities toward the Islamic Republic are due to the very nature of the Islamic establishment, and others are over political issues such as Palestine. Hello and welcome, everybody. Palestinian mourners have held a massive funeral procession for the victims of the latest Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. At least 11 Palestinians, including a 14-year-old boy and a 66-year-old man, were killed in the attack. Over 100 others were injured, several of them critically. Palestinian officials have requested an emergency session of the UN Security Council on the Israeli massacre in Nablus. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says two of its commanders are among those killed. The Israeli regime has intensified crackdown on Nablus and the nearby city of Jenin since the inauguration of the regime's far-right cabinet led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. On Thursday, 30-year-old Palestinian youth identified as Mohammed Nabil Fawzi Abu Sabah succumbed to injuries he suffered during a recent Israeli raid of a refugee camp in Jenin. More than 60 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces across the West Bank so far this year. The Israeli military has carried out airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip a day after killing nearly a dozen Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. There were no immediate reports of casualties and damage from the airstrikes. Our correspondent in Gaza, Asher Shannon, filled us in with more details.
Israeli fighter jets attacked two areas in the Gaza Strip between 5:30 and 6 a.m. This morning. The first location that was hit by the Israeli rockets was a Hamas training center in the west of Gaza City near the coastline. And the other one was in also a Hamas security post in Al Bureij refugee camp in the center of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli regime claims that the airstrikes were retaliation for what they said rockets that were fired from the Gaza Strip. Palestinian resistance groups, mainly Hamas's military wing, the Azim Qassam Brigades, retaliated to the airstrikes and the presence of Israeli fighter jets by firing heavy machine gun fire towards the Israeli fighter jets. While earlier, Palestinian resistance factions, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, condemned the carnage in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus that claimed the lives of around a dozen Palestinians. The spokesman of the Azim Qassam Brigades, the Hamas military wing, Abu Baida, said yesterday that the Palestinian resistance factions will retaliate and will not remain silent.
Iran's foreign minister has strongly condemned the latest Israeli massacre of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus.
The Zionist regime is facing multifaceted crises from within, and Netanyahu's cabinet is falling apart. Israel has resorted to bloodshed to cover up these crises, but what was witnessed in Nablus proved that resistance is not limited to Gaza alone. The entire West Bank has now turned into an epicenter of resistance against the occupying regime.
Amin Abdullahian's remarks came as condemnations are pouring in over the Israeli bloodshed of the Palestinians. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah said the cruel targeting of civilians confirms that the occupying regime can only be deterred by the weapon of the resistance fighters. In a message, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya branded the Nablus carnage as the Israeli regime's systematic terrorism. A separately resistance movement Hamas denounced the extrajudicial killing of Palestinians, saying that retaliatory attacks would be the only right response to Israel. Well, to further look into the recent Israeli aggression against Palestinians, we're now joined by Mona Kandil, who's with us from Ramallah. Also, we have activist and political commentator Laith Maruf, who's with us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mona in Ramallah, please bring us up to speed on the aftermath of the recent deadly Israeli raid that took place in the city of Nablus yesterday.
Not only the city of Nablus, we can say all the occupied West Bank cities are witnessing a day of anger and a sad day after the massacre that was carried out in Nablus, leading to the martyrdom of 11 Palestinians in Nablus alone, including three elderly over the age of 60. What happened yesterday is that Israeli forces raided Nablus city, claiming that they want to arrest or kill Palestinian fighters who are accused of being part of the Palestinian resistance or planning to carry out a number of anti-Israel operations. They surrounded a building there. They clashed with Palestinians inside it. And at the end of the day, they left the city after killing 11 Palestinians and wounding over 100 Palestinians. Today, a general strike, a day of anger, had been declared across the occupied West Bank with no schools, no transportation. Maybe let's say it's a way of expressing Palestinian sadness and anger amid calls from the Palestinian resistance groups for the Palestinians to go to the areas where Israeli military checkpoints are located. And there's a clear call to clash with the Israeli forces. Up till the moment, no protests and demonstrations have taken place today, but it's a general strike, a day of anger. Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to the killing of those 11 Palestinians in Nablus. And we have to mention that with the martyrdom of 11 Palestinians in Nablus, since the beginning of this year, 17 Palestinians were killed in Nablus alone, with dozens others had been killed in the occupied West Bank and in Al-Quds.
Right. Laith Maarouf, I want to get your perspective on the recent escalation of the Israeli violence against Palestinians. In addition to that also, I want to get your views on the response that we've been seeing from not just various countries, but also from the Palestinian Resistance Front, Hamas, Islamic Jihad. They've stated that the Israelis will see the consequences of the increasing of their aggression and their crimes. Are we on the cusp of a third intifada?
Well, look, everybody's playing right now a waiting game because, for instance, yesterday, the former prime minister of the Zionist colony, Lapid, stated that the economy of Israel will collapse in 6 months, that there will be a civil war within that 6 months in Israel. So what we see is that the resistance axis knows that there is a huge possibility of this internal collapse and civil war in Israel. And so they are trying to be patient and allow those things to roll out. At the same time, Netanyahu and his ilk know that, and they have their only way to avoid a civil war inside Israel and an internal collapse of the colony is through either creating a war with the Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza and Jerusalem, and or trigger a wider regional war. The threats increase to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and also yesterday, as we saw, the Israelis shelled South Lebanon, hitting a home under construction and a few farmlands in between the houses in a village in the south of Lebanon. So the Zionists are attempting in any way possible to externalize their contradictions within the state of Israel to create a war that could distract the contradictions within their own colony.
Let's go back to Mona. Mona, what can you tell us about how Palestinians feel about the international silence, a lack of proper response as we see these crimes continuing? Specifically, they've been escalating not just this year, but over the past several months.
Since the beginning of 2023, 64 Palestinians have been killed across Palestinian territory. And what the Palestinians are receiving are only condemnation from the international community. It's not enough for the Palestinians. Condemnation is okay, but they need from the international community to translate their statements into acts on ground. Israel must be, Israeli soldiers and Israeli military officials must be persecuted for the crimes. This is what the Palestinians want. Several cases had been taken to the International Criminal Court to bring Israeli criminals into justice, to be prosecuted, but nothing is going on. What the international community is doing is condemning Israeli crimes, at the same time condemning Palestinian acts of resistance, as if equaling between the victims and the criminals. It's not accepted for the Palestinians, so that's why they are fed up. They also want, and they consider it could be a good position from the Arab states. They want an immediate stop of the normalization of relations. Palestinians are demanding that at least Arabs should stop all acts of relations with the Israeli regime, and a more serious action from the international community. But at the end of the day, as long as the Israeli regime feels it's supported and backed by the American administration, then they would continue to act as a state above the law. They would continue to act their crimes against the Palestinians, knowing that nothing would happen against them.
All right, thank you, Peter. Laith Maruf joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and Ona Kandil joining us from Ramallah. Elsewhere, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says some bare animosity toward the Islamic Republic over its political stance, such as on the question of Palestine. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, however, that some hostilities are due to the very nature of the Islamic establishment. He said the Islamic Republic is opposed to those who believe in the West's policy of separating religion from social issues. He added Iran is also against the liberal democracy advocates who plan to loot the riches of the world in the name of freedom and democracy. The leader noted that Iran has thwarted such schemes by creating a nexus between democracy, freedom, and religion. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei urged caution against the enemy's plot of striking despair into the hearts of people. The leader further hailed the huge turnout of people in nationwide rallies marking the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. A man suspected of on Wednesday in the U.S. state of Florida returns to the scene of the crime, and a television reporter and a 9-year-old girl. Moses was arrested shortly after the second shooting. No explanation for why the man went on shooting rampages, but according to the police, Moses was believed to be an acquaintance of the first victim.
The shooting this morning, the two shootings of the two news reporters, and the shooting of the mother and the 9-year-old child are all connected. The same suspect, Mr. Moses, is responsible for all those shootings. He's been charged, formally charged, in the murder this morning, and we expect charges soon on all of the other victims.
Moses faces charges in the attack of two news reporters, as well as for the fatal shooting of the 9-year-old girl and wounding her mother inside the nearby home. He's already been charged with killing the woman in her 20s who was shot in a vehicle hours earlier. The Yemeni government has strongly condemned what it calls the United Nations' insidious plans to divide Yemen and the rest of the Middle East into smaller states subservient to Western imperialism. Yusuf Mauri reports from Sana'a.
The UN Special Envoy to Yemen, Haynes Grunberg, has been busy this week meeting with Yemeni and UAE officials in the Emirates. The UN envoy's office posted a tweet stating that the latest efforts are aimed at improving Yemen's living conditions and securing longer-term peace, security, and development. Given the UN's track record in Yemen, it behooves one to raise some questions about what security, peace, and development look like through the political lens of the United Nations. I visited Mohammed al-Nu'aymi, a member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, to hear his take on the UN's progress in establishing security, lasting peace, and development in Yemen.
The United Nations efforts and strategies in most of the nations they have been involved in have focused on two main efforts. The first effort is gathering intelligence for Western nations because it is the West who controls the UN. The second effort is to pave the way for Western states to implement their political agenda. For example, in Yemen, they want to control the country's political affairs and geography. If they are unable to achieve this, their second option is to divide Yemen.
Al-Nu'aymi also said the UN and its partners' political ambitions are not limited to Yemen.
They are not just planning to divide Yemen. They are planning to fragmentize the entire region, including the states that are helping them in this effort. For example, they are planning to divide Egypt into three states and Saudi Arabia into five states.
Abdel Khalik Qobar, a Yemeni judge I spoke with, said cases of war crimes should be filed against members of the United Nations, who he says are actively engaged in covering up the crimes against humanity perpetuated on Yemenis. In his televised speech last week, leader of Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdel Malik al-Houthi, called on the Yemeni people to be prepared for war in case peaceful efforts fail to bring about the Yemeni people's demands. The UN claims to be engaged in peaceful efforts to bring an end to the conflict in Yemen. However, according to Ansarullah officials, the UN body has been engaged in efforts to divide countries in the region. Officials we spoke with believe this is part of a greater plan which aims to prevent the Muslim world from uniting against Western imperialism. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hidden Files. Over 80% of the world's population uses a smartphone, but what over 80% of the world's population probably never thinks about is the true cost of the cobalt used in the batteries of smartphones, laptops, and electric vehicles. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi. And today we're going to tell you a story of hands. Hands that have for long been hurt beyond imagination while harvesting the main ingredients to our industries. But before we start today's story, we need to properly set the scene. Because though the country we're going to talk about is home to one of the poorest nations in the world, the land itself is perhaps the richest land on earth, or the country in question. the Democratic Republic of Congo, the country with the most abundant resources known on Earth, and yet home to one of the 10 most impoverished nations in the world. But it was at the hands of these impoverished people that Europe experienced its industrial boom in the late 1800s. And it all started with some of the same trees that you saw in the picture, the rubber tree. From bicycle tires to industrial bands, rubber played a big role in answering Europeans' daily demands, especially with the rubber boom in the mid-1800s. But rubber does not grow in Europe. And that's where the story of a Belgian king and his Congo comes in. The story about the toil of hands and their unlikely reward. Now, who was this Belgian king we're talking about, and what did he do?
King Leopold II was born to the first royal family following Belgium's independence. He seized Congo with the help of the explorer Henry Morton Stanley in mid-1880s. The king and his forces drained the land of resources, killing elephants for ivory and cutting down trees for rubber. The United States became the first country to recognize his claim to the Congo. Congolese hands were systematically amputated during his rule. The severed hands were then collected and smoked by the colonists to be preserved for later counting and recording. King Leopold was responsible for the biggest genocide in history, with 10 to 15 million killed by torture, famine, and diseases, and many others systematically maimed. The king was honored with Great Britain's most prestigious title, a member of the Order of the Garter, in 1916. Thousands of signatures and recent protests by Belgian people have called for the removal of his statues and the payment of reparations to the victims of the colonial crimes.
The people were clearly being punished for something, but that something was neither negligence nor a crime. Their Belgian masters had decided a certain rubber quota for them to harvest, and they had failed to reach their quota. But it wasn't only these slaves who had to pay for this failure. Let's just say the Belgian punishment system for the Congolese who hadn't met their quota, including cutting off the hands and feet of their loved ones. According to statistics, between 10 to 15 million Congolese were killed by King Leopold II during his 23 years of ownership of Congo. And though this number is millions more than the number of those killed in other genocides, few people know about Congo's Holocaust. At the time, this genocide committed by the Belgians slashed Congo's population in half. Imagine that, half of the population gone. But it's best to hear about all of this from one of our guests today, who is a historian specializing in colonialism in Africa.
Prothomio Gabriel is an activist and a member of an anti-colonialist imperialist organization called No White Saviors in Uganda. He specializes in African history, and with the organization, they have opened a Pan-African library in Kampala. He's also a social media expert and uses this specialty to educate the masses about the true history of Africa.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program today. Can you talk about the legacy of the Belgian king, King Leopold II, that legacy that he had on Congo?
We first have to highlight how, unlike other colonies, or unlike other entities that were classified as colonies, Leopold classified the Congo as a private property. It's vast land that had people on it, that had resources, that had landscapes and animals, was essentially the private property of one individual. And with that came his self-imposed right to do whatever he saw fit to exploit the people of the land however he saw fit. And the fact that it was private property meant that even the Belgian government, if I may say, at that time, all the Belgian political bodies didn't have a right to dictate or to interfere in whatever decision he took. And we see that with this came a reign of terror for the Congolese people, for the Congolese, Rwandan, and Burundian people. Because when we often talk about the Congo talk about Belgium, we often leave out the fact that Rwanda and Burundi also faced similar atrocities at the hands of the Belgians.
I mean, it's estimated up to 15 million Congolese were killed during Leopold's reign. Do you think that these numbers are accurate?
It could have possibly been more than 15 million. I'm one of the people who believe it was more than 15 million because when you look at the systemic situation as it was, the fact that for every hand that was chopped, it had to be accounted for. Every bullet that was fired had to be accounted for. So that meant taking back the arms of the victim or the hands of the victim back to the first public officials. I think that's how the force was referred to at that time. I'm not quite good with my French isn't quite good. But you see that the institutional or systemic system as it was at that point promoted violence against the Congolese people. For any small thing, you could have fallen short on your rubber collection and, you know, your child would pay the price or your family member would pay the price. Even you yourself would pay the price. So imagine that going on for years, day in, day out, years. It's easy for anyone to see that 10 million is an understatement.
What exactly is happening today in Congo? Because we see growing calls by the Congolese for the United Nations to even leave the country.
Yes, they are cries by the Congolese population to have MONUSCO expelled. I think MONUSCO is the UN mission in Congo, something like that. And it isn't for, and this cause is for a justified reason by the Congolese people, that throughout the decades that the MONUSCO has been active, they have questioned their input because the Congolese people are being slaughtered. And oftentimes you see that the MONUSCO entity doesn't act, or the UN entity doesn't act, only when it benefits them. I don't know if you're aware, but I think it was last year, a UN truck in the eastern part of the Congo overturned, and out of the vehicle came bags of minerals. So for the Congolese people, they are literally tired of being exploited. They're literally tired of this pseudo-sense of we're here to protect you, because that is not what is ongoing. The UN is plundering the wealth of the Congolese people, the wealth of the Congolese land.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Hidden Files. Though many of the horror stories in Congo's past involve rubber slavery, the oppression of this nation today has far more to do with another type of resource. You see, in addition to its limitless water supply, rich forests, and fertile soil, Congo is home to some of the world's most precious and most used minerals. Congo has abundant mineral deposits of cobalt, gold, diamonds, petroleum, potash, lead, zinc, uranium, copper, phosphates, gold, manganese, natural gas, coltan, and a whole lot more. Congo's untapped raw deposits of raw materials are actually estimated at being $24 trillion. Imagine that, $24 trillion. And Congo is the world's fourth largest producer of copper, copper that we use so much in this modern world of ours. 60% of the coltan on the planet, the reserves are in Congo. And perhaps most importantly, the country produces 70% of the world's cobalt, which is used in phones and laptops and other high-tech tools. You see, it's the Congolese who are the true owners of the cobalt. It's the Congolese who harvest it with their hands in unsafe mines. And it's the Congolese who suffer all kinds of health issues and birth defects as a result of this dangerous hands-on approach to cobalt harvest. And yet in 2018, over 70% of the Congolese lived on less than $1.90 a day. Clearly, even though their country is no longer the private property of a Belgian king, they continue to have little to no share in their rich national resources. But how is this happening today in what's now called the DRC, or the Democratic Republic of Congo? Our next guest has some interesting answers, so let's find out more.
Tedde Kofi is a broadcast journalist with credits on the BBC World Service and BBC Radio 5, where he presented Current Affairs magazine programs. Tedde is a newspaper publisher and ran the Ethnic Media Group, publishing Asian and Afro-Caribbean titles. He has been a crisis, media coach, and consultant for multinational corporations, specializing in the arena of diversity management.
Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. We appreciate you being with us today on the program. I want your assessment of the effects of Leopold's reign you think could have had on the overall psyche of the Congolese.
The barbarity, the savagery, and the cruelty that Leopold II wreaked on the Congo is one of the world's best-kept secrets. It is estimated that 10 million Congolese died, that he reduced the population of the country by about 70%. In the early days of Leopold, each Congolese man, able-bodied man, was supposed to produce 15 kilograms of rubber per day. If he did not produce that, his family would be rounded up, herded, and killed. And so if people didn't produce their quota, their hands were amputated. There were these bizarre scenes of people presenting like strings of male genitalia, Congolese male genitalia, just to show how many people that they had killed that day because they hadn't made their quota. Now, all of this was covered up by Leopold as an exercise in civilizing the savages, which we Africans were presented as. So he said that basically in the Congo Free State, which is basically my private fiefdom, I've gone over there to introduce them to God and Christianity. And of course, the missionaries were under dire admonitions never to reveal the truth, which of course ultimately leaked, because as slavery was abolished elsewhere, people started to ask questions about how Leopold was running this enterprise. And of course, the whole thing blew up in his face, and he then had to resort to burning all the national records to try and cover up and hide a genocide, which was, you know, in plain view. So again, this is another way in which, if you have lived through that kind of, let me call it a Holocaust, it's probably the greatest human genocide kind of in living memory. If you've been through that kind of genocide, the idea is to instill in the people obedience to authority and power.
How is it, though, that the exploitation of the Democratic Republic of Congo is still existing today, has taken place for so long a period of time?
The oldest playbook in method in the playbook of any totalitarian or any controller is divide and rule. Divide and rule requires that because there are few of the abusers, you must get the people you are abusing to fight each other. As long as they are fighting each other, they cannot unite, because it is only when they are united that they can kick you out of your position of authority, command, and control. And so it is that Congo has always been destabilized by foreign powers and foreign interests who have a profound desire, but whose lifestyles are determined by the cheapness with which they can extract the st- strategic minerals that I listed before.
Right.
And so that is how it's played out for the Congo. And another way is to make sure that you have proxy governments which are propped up by foreign powers, doing essentially the bidding of the foreign powers so that they can be the natural and easy exfiltration of the nation's wealth to the benefit of the foreign powers. So that's how it's always played. Divide and rule. Proxy governments, which are created by the foreign powers. And thus it has been to this very day. In fact, now there is another challenge because colonialism moved to another stage when, by using local agents, the destabilization could be maintained. And even now, if you speak to any Congolese, they will tell you that the role of Rwanda is a very difficult one in their country. And many Congolese blame a lot of the conflicts, internal conflicts within the country, on the actions not only of the Rwandese, but also of the Ugandans.
Well, why haven't we seen reparations for the Congolese after all of the suffering that they have gone through?
For a crime to be expunged, you need recognition that the crime happened. You need regret for the crime happening, and you need recompense. Now, in terms of recognition of the crime happening, my goodness, if you ask anybody what comes out of Congo, what they'll tell you is Makalele, Vincent Kompany, Lualua, and Romelu Lukaku, their top football players. Most people in the world don't even know what the history of the Congo is beyond some trite superficial modernities. In terms of regret, when the tooth of Patrice Lumumba was handed back to his family, here is the thing. There was no official apology, either on behalf of the Belgian state or on behalf of Leopold II, who committed most of those atrocities. So there is no regret there. And as for compensation, well, Congo's wealth is still being filched out of the country on a daily basis. And the parties who benefit from this are absolutely adamant about the maintenance of their profits. So it's a perfect storm for Africa's richest country. And you've got to think about the bigger picture as well. When Nkrumah stood up in Ghana, the independence of Africa was signaled. When Lumumba stood up in the Congo, the independence of the Congo was signaled. And the thing about these things is that they attract people who follow the cause. And so it is important in the interest of the controlling powers that Congo doesn't become as wealthy as she can be. What if then she starts supporting the rest of the other African countries, and then the yoke of colonialism will be broken one by one by one across the continent? If you want to defeat an enemy, you first defeat their champion, and Congo can be the champion of Africa. Just indeed, as Muammar Gaddafi could have been the champion of Africa. Look what happened to him.
Well, what is it going to take, in your perspective, to turn around the fate of the Democratic Republic of Congo?
All I can say is that if people are severely abused over a long period of time, it takes time for these people to heal, for them to find their center, and to make demands based on their own self-validation. So that work has to take place. But that work has to take place right now in the face of overwhelming media coverage, which makes sure that the only things people associate Congo with is Claude Makélélé and Victor Kompany, football players. People don't know outside of Africa the value and the condition of Congo. So all of this applies very, very negative pressure. On the other hand, The international community must write a new set of rules. And that set of rules should mean that all people, as said in the United Nations Charter, deserve respect and recognition. But at the moment, you know, the world is run by what one cartoonist called the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. And so as long as you've got this sort of moral relativism, it's going to be very challenging.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Tetti Kufi. Appreciate it. But when we talk about the advancement of technology, we often think of prestigious universities and creative minds. Unfortunately, we rarely remember the suffering of hands without whose harvest the main ingredients of advancement would be missing. Hands like those of the Congolese that were cut off for the sake of rubber and the harvest of cobalt. The pain must be acknowledged and the price be paid. But from the Belgian monarchy that has brought about the genocide of the Congolese to the international corporations and various countries that continue to profit from the toil of the Congolese and the taking away of their resources, no entity has acknowledged the crime committed against these people, let alone apologize. Yet even a formal apology can hardly ever appease the victims of such horrible crimes. What good would an apology have done, for instance, the Congolese man who had to stare in shock at the severed body parts of his 5-year-old daughter? I can't even begin to imagine. Well, a true apology must be followed by a change in actions and in reparations, such as those that has for decades been paid by German citizens to those related to victims of Nazi atrocities. Perhaps someday soon, the oppressed nations of the world will begin to have the power to extract this apology from colonial powers of the past and present. But this power requires knowledge. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Harabi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Harabi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Harabi English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, brothers and sisters, dear listeners, welcome to Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. I am your host, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. One of the keys of life is maintaining the health and growth of our hearts. When it comes to our hearts, it's by far the most important organ in the body, from a spiritual aspects and from a physical aspects. Physically, if the heart stops pumping blood, the person will die. And when the heart gets hardened, it cuts the relationship between the servant and his creator. Having said that, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam have gave us many ahadith, many traditions in this regard, where they told us how we can take better care of our hearts when it comes to food or when it comes to spirituality. And sometimes you'll find out that food itself hurts the heart, even spiritually. So let us look at some of the hadith in this regard. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he says, Al-aqlu gharizatun tuzidu bil-ilm wa-tajarab. Intellect, or as we call impulses, he says it increases a person's knowledge and experience. And he also said, كَثْرَةُ النَّظَرِ فِي الْحِكْمَةِ تُلَقِّحُ الْعَقْلِ. You know, when a person spends too much time trying to learn wisdom, he said that itself, it cleanses and it actually pollinates the heart. So the heart is just like a, if you think of it as a tree, it will not give a fruit until it's pollinated. The heart is the same. It will not give fruit until a person decides to take care of it and gives it plenty of knowledge for it to grow. And he also said, بِتَرْكِ مَا لَا يُعْنِيكَ يَتُمُّ لَكَ الْعَقْلِ. When you avoid and stay away from things that do not concern you, then your intellect will become complete. And he also said, تَرْكُ شِرْبِ الْخَمْرِ تَحْسِينًا لِلْعَقْلِ. Not drinking alcohol is protection for the heart. So we can see that there is a huge link between spirituality when it comes to knowledge and when it comes to gaining information, and also when it comes to physical things that we consume that also could affect the heart. So the Imam says, learn knowledge, your growth of the heart will become a lot. Avoid drinking alcohol, and also your heart will be a lot better. And then we want to have a look at the hadith of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam in these two categories, the physical aspects and the spiritual aspects, in more detail. So I just give you some of the hadith that just talks about, you know, an overall view. We want to be more specific, and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, they have done that. So let us take a short break and then we continue right after.
آیت الله جوادی آملی, the author of the book مفاتیح الحیات, the keys of life.
این مفاتیح باید دو جلد باشه, چندین سال این حرف گفته میشه.
This book مفاتیح ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است, چه فرون دماز و سواب داره فرون روزون است.
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرون درختکاری اینجا کم ثواب داره, دعا هم داره, ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام همونطوری که این رو گفته برم گفته دیگه, اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره, همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Oh. Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are still listening to the program Keys of Life, Mafatih al-Hayat. So what are the effects of food on the growth of the heart? The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, he says, إِذَا اتَّخَذَ أَحَدُكُمْ مَرَقًا فَلْيَكْثُرُ فِيهِ الدُّبَاءَ. He says, if a person wants to eat plenty of soup, then let him have plenty of pumpkins in it. Obviously, pumpkins have a lot of properties in terms of giving the body what it requires from nutrients and vitamins and what have you. And the Prophet explains why is that. Why is it important for us to have a lot of pumpkins in our soup? He says, فَإِنَّهُ يُزِيدُ فِي الدَّمَاغِ وَالْعَقْلِ. For it will increase the power and strengthens your intellect and your heart. So when the heart is healthy, when the mind is healthy, then it can function in the proper manner. So when it comes to the heart, if it's healthy and it's pumping blood, then the person is more, let's say he is more in a way safe, secure and healthy enough to perform all the acts that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants from him. If he's sick and he has heart issues, then that will hinder his progress towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the same with the intellect. When the intellect is weak and the person cannot comprehend things or understand things or become creative, then that brain is pretty much dead, as we call it. It becomes a vegetable. So the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi, he says, eat pumpkins. It's good for your heart, and it's also good for your mind. Amir al-Mu'mineen says, إِنَّ الْحُجَامَةَ تُصُحُّ الْبَدَنَ وَتَشُدُّ الْعَقْلِ. Cubbing, he says, it makes the body safe and healthy, and also firms the brain and the intellect. And when it comes to hujama, the process of cubbing, which is extracting the excess blood from the body, it's one of the things that in Islam is very highly emphasized, that a person should do it more often, at least once a month, once every few months, or at least once a year. It's very recommended Islamically, and it has many health benefits. I mean, even if you do not look at it from an Islamic perspective, but you look at it from, let's say, health perspective, it has many, many benefits. And you see that the hadith from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa and the Ahl Bayt in this regard are so many to count. But this is just one of them. He says, if you do the cupping and you extract the blood from your system, the excess blood, he says it will make your body healthy and it will firm your intellect, which is something that we want. Imam Sadiq salamullah alayhi, he says, مَنْ تَطَيَّبَ أَوَّلِ النَّهَارِ لَمْ يَزَلْ عَقْلَهُ مَعَهُ إِلَى اللَّيْلِ. Also another dimension. He says, he who puts perfume at the beginning of the day, his intellect will remain with him until, or all the way until nighttime, which is again an emphasis on perfume. And when a person smells perfume in the morning and early in the morning when he wakes up, it opens up his mind, it opens up his chest. You know that feeling that you get of comfort, of relief when you smell perfume? That is what the Imam is talking about. You feel more happy, excited to begin your day, and it will continue. We'll leave it here and we will continue in other episodes. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.